are you located?
Calgary, Alberta, Canada.
Oh, nice. Nice.
So, yeah, I actually... Yeah, we saw you way back when you played here with Danger Danger and you played with Warrant. So many years ago.
That was like the arena where they turned the stage around, right?
It was, well, actually it was the Frank Sisson Silver Dollar Bowl and Action Center.
Oh, that, was that the one where we played an after show? I'm trying to think of where the hell, I don't know, it wasn't Vancouver, it was like a little bit, what's the next major town in Canada that is east of Vancouver? Isn't it Calgary?
Yeah, pretty much. Calgary, Edmonton, those are the two that are east from Vancouver, really.
But Edmonton is further east than Calgary, correct?
Well, Edmonton's further north. I mean, similar east-wise.
Oh, similar, okay. I could have sworn that one of those places we played wherever the damn hockey team plays, and, you know, of course, Warren and Danger Danger couldn't fill an arena. So what they did was, where the stage usually is to fill an arena, they just turned it around, and we literally played to, like, 1/8 of the arena. Like, just, you know, like if the stage was set up the long way, it would be flipped around.
Oh, God, yeah, I can't imagine that, but, yeah. So
I thought that, maybe you're right. I don't remember playing a bowling alley there, but... Your memory is probably better than mine. Anyway, fire away.
Yeah, all right. I'll start this interview up. Heyo, and here we go. Welcome to another episode of We Talk Music. I am your host, Mr. Brett Podcast, and I am super happy to have a guest on that I've been itching to talk to for a long time. He is the bassist for Danger Danger. He is the bassist for The Defiance, which is the reason that we are here to talk about their new album. He is Bruno Ravel. Bruno, how are you?
How you doing, guys? I am glad to be here, and I am doing great.
Well, that's awesome. And we are, like I said, we are here to talk about Zokusho, the second album from The Defiance, which is absolutely awesome.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
And, you know, it seems to me that that you're getting so much praise for both The Defiance albums. And I understand why. I mean, it's just really good, strong rock and roll that fits that need for just that fun rock.
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually a little bit surprised by it as well. I think there is a void in that kind of music, at least maybe in the, I don't want to like boast or anything, but maybe in the quality department. there might be a lot of or some bands putting out material that is like this, but I think that we're definitely filling a void with this kind of like aggressive, you know, catchy AOR, whatever, what have you kind of music. So I'm glad about that.
Well, and it's great to hear you with Paul Lane again. And I mean, Rob Marcello's awesome, but I mean, everybody is amazing in the band. Like, Paul Lane's vocals are just killer.
Yeah, he's still got it, man. He really, you know, prides himself on, especially, you know, when we go into the studio, he makes sure that, you know, I always tell him, I go, you sure you want to sing that high? I go, you're not going to be able to do that live. And he's like, well, I only have to do it once. He says, we could always key the song down if we ever play it live. And I'm like, okay. And I always get a little bit worried because when he sings that high, like I think his head's going to fly off his body. it's not easy.
No, but I mean, I think it speaks to the band, like the idea that you just put absolutely everything out there, and I think that shows to the fans when you listen to the album.
Well, thank you, appreciate it. Yeah, we definitely, you know, this is something like a void personally that I felt when after Danger Danger finished. Our last album, I think it was in 2009, and I love recording and writing, and Paul is just a great partner for me because we kind of complement each other, And we, you know, obviously there's that history because we worked with each other before. So it's just a really cool thing, and we enjoy it. We enjoy working hard in the studio and trying to write the best stuff we can write at the moment.
So let's talk about the writing for the album. How does that all work?
It's pretty easy. I mean, since Paul's in Vancouver and I'm in New York, there is a time difference. But usually what we do and what we both kind of agreed upon before we even started this thing is that, you know, there wasn't going to be any songs that was, for instance, three-quarters of the way written by myself or three-quarters of the way written by Paul, and that kind of thing was going to be a total, you know, I don't want to say 50-50 because not every song is 50-50, but, you know, basically what happens is that if, whether it's Paul that has an idea or myself that has an idea, we kind of lay down a rough sketch, send it to the other guy, whether he sends it to me or I send it to him, and then we just compile as many of these as we can, and whichever ideas that the other person gravitates towards are the ones we finish. And so sometimes, you know, I might get a little bit upset because I have an idea that I feel strongly about and Paul just doesn't feel it, and vice versa. So, but in the end, it's fine because the fans love it. And again, I wouldn't want to force anything down Paul's throat, and I don't think he would want to force anything down my throat. So it's kind of the way we work. We're very democratic. We rarely bicker about anything, which is so much fun because, you know, when I work with Danger Danger or other people, when I write with other people, there's usually a lot more arguing. So with this, there's really no arguing. It's just kind of like, oh, you don't like that idea? Okay, let's move on. Or vice versa, you know? So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, that's great when you can have a relationship like that. Now, I know in the case of the first album, you said that you wound up having a lot of extra songs. So is there a lot of extra songs for this album too?
There are definitely some extra, you know, kind of beginnings of songs. I don't know if there are extra finished songs, but on the first album, we had maybe, you know, four or five things that we could have, you know, finished in an hour or something. So there was more like completely finished songs for the first album. With these, we kind of, you know, now that we kind of know the way we were working, when it was an idea that again had hit like a stalemate or something, we just kind of left it there. So there are some that are more complete than others, and there are songs that are just basically sketches that are laying around.
Now, one of the things I'm really interested about is you know, because I was listening to some Danger Danger as well with Paul singing, and so I can tell the difference myself, but I'm interested in how you feel the two bands are different.
Well, the Danger Danger thing with Paul, it depends on what you're listening to. I mean, because what happened in Danger Danger when he joined the band is that he was totally unaware of how Steve and I write and how you know we would construct songs, and he kind of came in with his own ideas, and so there was a lot of friction between Steve and Paul because again, mainly myself, when I write, I'm mainly a melody guy and I write very few lyrics. Yeah, I usually will come up with the title of the song or maybe a few lines here and there, like I'll fill in the blanks or come up with the theme, come up with the title. But Steve is mainly a lyricist, and the same with Paul. So when the two of them got together, there was a lot of arguing over, you know, which perspective the song was going to be written from, and they didn't really agree a lot. So there was friction, and then what happened with that is that turned into Steve and myself writing complete songs, and then Paul writing a complete song, and us just combining them on the record so we wouldn't have that kind of, I'm trying to think of the right term, just that tension creatively. We didn't want to have that. So we were like, you know what? An album has 10 songs. You know, Steve and I will write 7 and you write 3. and we'll agree on the songs, and then we'll, and so that's the way it kind of went with that. So, but you could definitely hear when you just listen to the songs that Steve and I write that it's a little, it's definitely different than the stuff that I write with Paul, because when I write with Steve, we were definitely under more constraint, and we were trying to get on the radio, we were trying to write hit songs, we were trying to write a certain formula of music, and with the Defiance, even though it's the same genre, there are no rules. So, you know, there might be a song that's like super pop, and then the next song is super, like almost heavy metal. So we would never do that in Danger Danger. That's the great thing about the Defiance, is that there's just no rules. Like, we just kind of, you know, because my interests musically, you know, range from like super heavy shit to the sugar, the most sugariest like pop stuff you could ever hear, almost even boy band material, right? So, and Paul kind of, you know, has his own flavors, right? So I don't mind having a song that's super pop on a record, write it and follow it with a heavy metal song. It doesn't bother me at all. And that's what's great, because when Paul sings on it and when I put my spin on it, it all comes full circle back into melodic rock AOR land with the production. So it might be disguised, you know, it's disguised that way, but it might start off as a heavy metal song or a super pop song. So that's what's great about the Defiance. It's really no rules. And that's what I think the difference is.
Yeah, and it must be so freeing to not have those rules and not be trying to write that just for a specific, you know, just for the radio, really.
Yeah, it's mainly the radio, you know. Before, when I would write with Danger Danger or with Steve, we were very conscious. Like, we would throw full songs out if we didn't think that they were hits. Wow. We wanted every song to be radio ready. And now we don't have to worry about that. So every song doesn't have to be radio ready. And there are a lot of songs that are on the radio that are awesome. So, mm-hmm. You know, it's like, so again, it is freeing. It's very freeing.
Well, and I assume that tension is pretty much gone with Steve guesting on the drums on this new album.
Yeah, I mean, the Steve guesting with the drums was something that, you know, we were kind of, the way we map songs out is I kind of, you know, put down a loose drum program, and we kind of form the song that way. And then when we get to the point where we have to actually record the real drums, then then that's when I have to go either find a drummer, or on the first album I use Van Romaine, who's awesome. And so on this album, when I was listening to the songs, they were a little bit less busy than the first album. So, you know, I always talk to Steve. I talk to him every day almost. And, you know, we were kind of joking around. I was like, oh, man, it's almost time I got to cut the drums. And then, you know, he was I was joking around with him. I was like, hey, you know what? You should play the drums. And he was like, and then one day he said, I'll do it. And I was like, really? That's something you would do? And he said, yeah. And I said, all right, so then let's do it. So, it's actually cool because it keeps the whole, you know, Danger Danger family, you know, the kind of the chatter on, or keeps the name on everyone's lips. And that's kind of what you need now. You know, you need to keep the juice going, because that's all it is. There's no, you know, there's nobody promoting our record except for social media. So the more, you know, we get a little extra juice out of this record because Steve's name is involved. So now there's fans of Danger Danger that normally maybe wouldn't listen to the Defiance, because maybe, you know, it's not on their radar, but then all of a sudden Steve will post something on social media, hey, I played drums on this record, and all of a sudden you get those extra people that go, oh, wait, Steve's involved, I'm in now. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's actually mm-hmm. cool. It's actually cool that he did it. And it was a breeze, actually, 2 days in the studio.
Well, yeah, that's super fast, no doubt.
Yeah,
because for me, like, I mean, I really came across the Defiance from the first album because, you know, we love Paul Lane, given the fact, I mean, you know, Canadian treasure. So, and I mean, Danger Danger, we've been big fans of Danger Danger for a long time. And so when I discovered it, I was really interested, and then I listened to it, and I just remember thinking, holy crap, I haven't heard an album this good in years. And so...
Oh, man, so cool.
when you know, knowing that you had a second album coming out, and it's just like, I mean, it's great because as a fan of Danger Danger, you can still get new music, but it is that little bit different from Danger Danger. So it does it feels different, but right.
Exactly. And don't forget, you know, there's a lot of the Paul Lane influence in the Defiance, actually, you know. It's like, you know, he's writing his melodies, the ones that he writes. You know, it's very hard to kind of tell the difference between the stuff he writes and the stuff I write. But what I'm saying is that there's a lot more of that Canadian Paul Lane flavor in the Defiance than there was in Danger Danger.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I can absolutely see that. Now, one of the things I'll ask about is that you've worked with some amazing singers in your time. I mean, Paul Lane, obviously, you got Ted Poley, and also Tony Harnell, who's just a friend of the show and just an amazing singer. So is it kind of luck, or is it just that you've happened to find these great singers to be able to work with?
I think they found, well, I found Ted, and then we found Paul, and then I think the thing with Tony was, I'm trying to think of how I was contacted to get involved with him. I think he just called me up. I mean, we've been friends for a long time, so, I think you just luck, and also maybe being in the same town as Harnell. That probably had something to do with it.
Yeah, I mean, he's a great guy. Absolutely, like, just really fascinating to listen to and stuff like that. And I think that's the awesome thing. I love, it's one of the things I absolutely love is all the interconnection of the people within that genre, I guess. How you know, you go out once with Danger Danger, and then you know you got backing vocals on Cherry Pie and that kind of thing, and then you're with Tony and that kind of, and it's all so neat because it's just so interconnected.
Yeah, man, it's one, you know, we're all from the same genre, we're all kind of the same age, so it's like, you know, we all know each other, and then through touring, you know, with certain bands, you become friends with people, you stay in touch, and then, you know, hey, I need a guitar player. Hey, let's call so-and-so up. He's, you know, I know him from whatever band, and he's, you know, available, you know. Yeah, so we all know each other now. Great.
let's talk about touring. How do you tour with the Defiance?
I'm not going to lie. I mean, it's going to be tough because logistically, you know, we're we'd have to probably all either meet, depending if we were going to play in Europe, we'd have to all fly to Europe, me and Paul and myself and whoever was going to play drums, and rehearse there. Or if we were going to do something in Canada, we'd probably all have to fly to Vancouver. So logistically, it's definitely a nightmare. But what we're trying to do as far as, you know, shows is just put the word out there that we, you know, we're available and we do want to do some sort of touring. It just has to make sense. And it's not so much financially, it's just more with, you know, not beating ourselves up physically too much, because we're not young guys anymore. So we can't really, you know, rough it and go kill ourselves for a month and, you know, have those 4 a.m. lobby calls so we can drive 12 hours to the next city to play for 100 people. We can't really do that. So we have to be strategic about it, whether it's like an opening slot or, you know, waiting for these, you know, festivals or cruise ships or what have you, you know, those kind of things. So we're putting the word out there that we'd like to do something and we'd like to, you know, maybe get on some of these shows. Whether it happens or not is totally up to fate and luck.
Yeah.
Because, being honest, the Defiance is not Danger Danger. Danger Danger has a lot more weight. So, it's going to be hard for us to actually pull off some the touring, but we're going to try.
Now, just as a something that kind of popped into my head. Now, Michael Schenker went out, or has gone out with his Michael Schenker Fest, and has many of his lead singers. Would there ever be a thought of kind of having Danger Danger with both Ted and Paul on the bill?
But, I mean, we talk about that all the time, how much fun that would be if we did, like, Danger Fest, you know, in certain cities where we just, you know, played small places and had everybody that was ever associated with the band. You know, even Scott Brown from Trooper, the bass player, who actually played bass in Danger Danger on a tour, and I played it. That would be awesome. Like, get him there, too. You know, get anybody that was ever associated with us to play and do, you know, we can maybe do multiple night thing where we play a certain album in its entirety. We talk about that all the time. We just don't know if it's something that would anybody would care about, you know?
Well, I can tell you that I would travel for that. There's no doubt about that in my mind.
Thanks. You know, it's the same. Like myself, I have these like obscure bands and artists that I loved growing up, or even after I was growing up, that I follow. And I always say, you know, like this. For example, there's this band that I love called the Producers. And they're based out of Georgia, and they're kind of like I don't know if you remember them. They were kind of like a little bit like the Police in a way, but more pop. They were kind of like a mixture of Cheap Trick and the Police. If you put those two bands together, you would get the Producers, right? So they had like three albums out on Epic in the '80s, and anyway, so they only play in the Georgia, Atlanta, Georgia area. And so I'm saying to myself, if I want to go see these guys, I'm going to have to get on a plane and go see them. And I would.
Yeah. Oh, I know. I know exactly what that's like. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, yeah, if we could do a thing where, you know, if it's in Europe or, you know, in the States, there's only, you know, a few places where it would make sense. And that would be, you know, either in the Northeast where I am, or maybe in like in the Chicago area. And that, to me, would be the only two places that we could probably pull something like that off. Because in the West Coast, they never really cared about us that much. And, you know, in the South, maybe, you know, maybe. But who the hell knows?
Yeah. Now, my normal co-host, who unfortunately couldn't be here today, is, I mean, we're both big fans, but, like, he's a really big fan of Janie Lane. And so I know that he'd want me to just kind of ask you about Janie and what it was like working with him and touring with him.
Yeah, he was the best. I mean, so I want to say I don't want to say underrated, because there are plenty of us that knew how talented he was, but he was a monster. He was just so talented, great songwriter, great singer. He was a little bit. He was definitely a crazy guy. You know, liked to party a lot, and you know, he and I always got along very well. And you know, obviously, our first tour that we ever did was with them. You know that because you were there. And and then after that, we were always tight with those guys. For some reason, I guess we just bonded with that band, and we would always visit each other on the road. And when Steve and I were writing Screw It, we lived in L.A. for about 6 to 8 months. We were there, and that's when we guested on the Cherry Pie record, and we were always hanging out with them anyway. We, you know, we'd just go meet them for lunch or something. So yeah, so Janie was a great guy, and I still miss him to this day, man. Every time I hear the songs on the radio, I just go, damn, man, it's such a shame he's not with us anymore.
Yeah. I mean, that tour must have been just crazy, just from the fact that, I mean, the small venues, the two bands that were just, you know, basically almost in the same position in their careers at that time. I mean, an amazing show to think back on it. I mean, I must have been like 19 years old or something like that. But
Yeah, I mean, they, you know, we kind of learned a lot from, you know, from those guys as far as like, just what the road was like and how crazy it could get. We every day we'd be on tour, we'd be like, oh, we can do that? Oh, cool, you know. And Ted actually, you know, learned a lot of his stage persona from Janie. And it's so much so that we would actually get mad at him. We would be like, dude, man, you got to stop, you know, running around the stage like Janie Lane, like, you know, do your own thing. And he would he didn't even realize that he was like copying his moves and stuff, you know. So we had to kind of dial it back for him. But yeah, I mean, they were just great guys, great band.
That's awesome. Yeah, and is that the kind of thing now that when you go out on tour that you kind of hope to be that for opening acts that you get?
I would say yes, but we're so old now that I wouldn't want any band to act like us on stage. We kind of, it's like every year I watch the videos of us playing, we're kind of slowing down. We're running around a lot less. Now we kind of just stand in one place. And so, yeah, I wouldn't, but as far as like the banter that we have on stage, we still kind of have that bar band vibe that we did when we started up that not a lot of bands have. And that's totally from growing up in New York and going to all the bars in New York and Long Island, and where the bands had to play like three sets, you know, three 45-minute sets and kind of, or 3-hour-long sets, and it was a lot of talking. So we learned a lot of that from Twisted Sister and bands like that that would just, they could just sit there, and actually their raps were better than when they played.
Right.
We would watch them and go, listen, you don't have to play anymore, just talk. They were comedians, so... So that part still stays the same, but the moving around on stage and how we are is getting a lot slower.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because I've seen so many bands, newer bands, that they actually seem like they're like five completely different people on stage, and obviously they're different people, but they all have different ways of acting on stage, and so it seems very disparate in the way that it comes off to the crowd. And I think that
Absolutely. When
you talk about the banter like that, that's something that really brings it all together. Like, you feel like a cohesive band, and the fans are watching a band that has done this before and just works in sync with each other.
Absolutely, and that's one cool thing about Paul as well, is that he's been around me and Steve and the other guys so much that he kind of, you know, at first it was culture shock when Paul would be hanging out with us for so long that he kind of started slowly turning into a New Yorker and getting that same kind of edge that we had, that Steve and I had. And then he would start, you know, joking around on stage, and we kind of, you know, rag on each other on stage, and people would just crack up. So it's like when we every summer we play these corporate gigs at Sweden Rock, where we do like these acoustic shows in these big tents, and a lot of people come. And when that happens, the fans actually like it so much when we talk that, you know, they'll just sit around all day and listen to us like rag on each other. Like, it's hysterical. It's great.
Well, you know, it just feels so real. I mean, I know as a fan, like I saw John Hiatt and Lyle Lovett in concert, and that was half of the show. It was just them talking together, them telling stories, doing a little bit of ragging on each other and that kind of thing. And, you know, that's one of the best shows ever.
Yeah, I think that's something that we need to do, is some sort of like, you know, really kind of quaint, like storyteller kind of thing, where we just kind of, you know, get some acoustic guitars and sing songs and just sit around and talk, because it seems like that's like a big thing, especially amongst like, you know, crowds that are a little bit older.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of cool. I like it.
Well, because virtually every song has a story. Every band has stories about when you performed that song. Like, you know, I was in Minnesota and playing, you know, Screw It, and blah, blah, blah happened. And like,
and you know what's funny? What's really funny now is now that we're all getting older, each guy has a different recollection of how it happens, and it causes a ton of arguments. It's like, we'll tell a story, and one guy will say, that's not the way it happened, it happened like this. And then the other guy will say, you're crazy, that's not how it happened. It's hysterical. Hysterical.
Oh, man, that does sound amazing. Yes, we...
Our memories are all going a little. It's kind of funny.
Well, yeah, it's like, you know, the three sides to every story, yours, mine, and the truth, right?
Absolutely.
And nobody cares about the truth anymore. It's just how good a story can you get?
No, they just want to hear us argue.
Oh, that's fun stuff. Well, to get back to the new album, I actually wanted to ask about the cover, and because it's an amazing cover.
Thank you. So yeah, the cover. How do I explain the cover? Okay, well, obviously the word "Who Show" means it's loosely translated to mean the sequel or the next chapter in Japanese. So we're having trouble coming up with a title for the record, and I didn't want to title it one of the titles of the songs. I thought that was kind of thoughtless. I thought we could have come up with a better title, and Paul and I were kind of racking our brains trying to come up with titles, and then one day I was walking around the house and I just said, I go, what about like the Roman numeral 2 or something like sequel? And I like the word sequel, but I didn't like it in English. So then, right away, my mind always goes to Japan for some reason, because I'm just fascinated with Japanese culture, and I always loved, it's my favorite place to tour and to play and visit. So I said, wow, it'd be cool if we did some sort of Japanese thing. So I called a friend of mine, sort of texting actually a friend of mine in Japan, and asked them how to say sequel in Japanese. And so my friend came back and told me, there's like 8 different words that could mean sequel in Japanese. So I looked at them all, and they were all kind of, in the kanji, in the Japanese writing, they all look the same, obviously, to someone who's not Japanese. But in the English pronunciation, all the words were very different, and the only one that looked cool to me was Zokusho. When I saw that, I said, oh, that looks cool. I said, it's something that somebody that doesn't know how to speak Japanese could easily kind of phonetically sound that out. So I said, I like Zokusho. So then, as soon as we had the title, then, right away I went back to the first album. And the first album, when my idea for the first album came from Love and Bullets, because when we had that song, I says, okay, Love and Bullets, and I thought of this whole Western thing, because I love, the 70s Clint Eastwood movies, for Fistful of Dollars.
Yeah, oh yeah, the spaghetti westerns, so, for sure. Yeah.
So I loved those movies as a kid, and when I decided to put the Carillon's theme as the intro to the first album, I'm sorry, this is a long-winded answer, but this is kind of how I got around to this. So I called Paul up and I said, what about, since we have the Sergio Leone music before Love and Bullets, I said, what about if we just have some, we do some sort of Western thing where I go 3 kind of like, ominous figures, like, in the distance, and basically my point is that I didn't want us to be on the album cover, on the first album. I just wanted it to be like these 3 kind of silhouettes in the background. And for some reason, Stan Decker, who also did the artwork for the first album, started drawing pictures that looked like us. And I really hated that. I just kind of looked at it and I was like, ugh, I don't want to be a cowboy on the cover of my album. And I didn't really have time to deal with it because I was dealing with, the record and recording all the stuff and production and all that. So I said, I just told Paul, I go, listen, I go, you deal with this. I don't really care what happens to it. And so it kind of turned into a movie poster, and Paul kind of liked it. I don't mind it, but it wasn't my favorite. You know what I mean? Like, when I look at that album cover, I just go, that album cover would be great if I wasn't on it. So I didn't want to be on the cover. I just don't like those kind of covers when the band members are on there. So anyway, fast forward to Zokusho. So I told Paul about the idea of a street in Tokyo. And he says, okay, that sounds cool. And I was like, all right. So then I you know, I said, okay, I definitely don't want to be on this cover. I don't want it to be like, oh, okay, here are the three guys on, now they're in Japan, you know, and then in the next album, they're going to be in the desert in Saudi Arabia. You know, I don't want it to be like that. So I told Stan, I go, listen, I go, we're not us on the cover. So he's like, okay. And I sent him examples of really cool, like anime, like, of kind of what I was going for. And it was so weird and so cool because literally in two emails, we were very, very close with that cover. I sent them the street, like a picture of just a street in Japan, because a lot of streets in Tokyo are very, very narrow. So I was like, I don't want it to be this like wide, like boulevard, you know, with, you know, tons of lights. I said, I want it to be like really kind of spooky, you know, like off the beaten path street with three just cool guys wearing suits, you know, like, but not us. I said, three anime guys. So, and he just came back with that, like, at a couple of emails. And I was like, I love this. I love it. It's like my favorite album cover that I've ever been associated with. So I really, really like it.
I really like, yeah, because I love the look of the street and just the 3D kind of vision of the street and the little bit of neon kind of colors and that. So, yeah, I mean, it really stands out. There's no question about it. And very different from the first album.
Yeah, I just think it's like that's kind of like if you take that cover and apply a Western theme to it, that's kind of what I wanted the first album to be. You know, that was kind of like my vision. I wanted it to be three guys, but I wanted us to be so far in the background that you didn't even know that it could be us. Like some people are, you know, sending me messages saying, oh, well, are you supposed to be the guy on the left? And I'm like, if you want to think I'm the guy on the left, that's fine. I said, I'm not supposed to be on the cover at all. It's just supposed to be three dudes. So anyway, so yeah. So yeah, it turned out great. The only thing that I had to tweak a little was in the original, like the first couple of drafts, like Stan had us a lot closer to the front. Like the figures were a lot bigger, and I kept saying, no, push us in the back, further in the back, further in the back. and then he kind of made the signage in the street. A lot of it was written in Korean, and I'm like, I'm going, we're in Tokyo. So I had to like send them different signs that were actually written in Japanese because I don't know if you're aware, but if you see like Korean writing, there's a lot of circles in Korean writing, and that's how I can recognize it. I don't know how to read Korean at all, but Korean like kanji has a lot of circles, and Japanese has kind of straight lines, and then the Chinese has a lot of like box kind of things that look like boxes, like tic-tac-toe kind of things. So that's the only way I could tell them apart. So when I'm looking at the sign, I'm going, is that Japanese or is that Korean? And then I had to ask my friend and yada yada yada. Anyway, that's how we got to the cover, and it's really cool. I love it. I can't wait to. I don't know who the first person is going to come up to me with that album cover, but I'm gonna have to buy him a drink or something because I can't wait to autograph that thing.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. I can well imagine. Now, in this case, you mixed the album as well, like and you know, is that always kind of your intention? Is to be able to do as much work on the album as possible?
Well, the only thing that I would do if we had a bigger budget, the only thing that I would do was have someone else master it. Mm. But the way the recording process works these days, it's like you're kind of mastering as you're mixing now. So, you know, it's kind of like a necessary evil. That's my favorite thing to do is to mix. So, when I'm that to me, that's like the most fun and the most creative thing for me to do is to mix, because I'm always trying to challenge myself, always trying to beat what I did before or beat the mix that I did before. So it's stressful, but it's very rewarding for me. And I just really enjoy that process the most out of anything, more than the songwriting or the recording. It's the mixing that I love the most.
Wow, that's interesting, because I'll bet you, especially in your own case, like do you ever feel like you're too close to the music, or does that not?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, but the thing is, it's like I'm so critical about like the mixing and stuff. Is that there's very few people that I would hand it off to and trust that they're going to do a good job. So, and those people are super expensive. probably take our whole budget. So, you know, for me, it's like doing these kind of records, I always kind of challenge myself to see if I could even just get in the same arena or same ballpark as my idols, you know, the guys that I idolize as mixers. So I'm constantly referencing my mix against their mix, and I'm never going to get, you know, I don't know if as good or sonically the same, but if I can A/B my mix to say someone like Chris Lord Alge or Mike Shipley or guys like that that I love their mixing, if I can A/B my mix with theirs and it's in the same ballpark, I'm there. That's kind of the way I judge it.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, their mixes are fantastic for sure.
Yeah.
Do Paul and Rob ever, like, kind of pipe in with the mixing, or is that just kind of yours?
Yeah, no. Paul definitely, not with the mixing so much. I mean, he might, like, what happened, I definitely want them to hear it and kind of listen to it on their systems and see if they're hearing the same thing that I'm hearing, or if, you know, sometimes, you know, Paul will bring something to my attention that maybe I missed, right? So he usually listens to it and say, hey, you know, like, you know, I'm having trouble hearing this vocal, or could you bring this section a little bit more down, or this needs to be a little bit more dynamic. I actually love when they give me little comments, because then I want to please all of them, you know what I mean? Not just myself. So, but it's the case that with the Defiance, there hasn't really been that many comments. Usually I send it to Paul and he's like doing a happy dance. And just says, it sounds amazing, you know, because like for me, like the main thing in mixing is you got to hear the vocal at all times.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
The vocal is the star, right? So it's like, I don't even care if I hear the bass on the record. Like to me, the bass is like the last thing I worry about. You know, for me, it's like vocals, drums, guitars, and then candy, everything else. So usually they're happy with the mix when I'm done with it.
Yeah, no, that's fun to hear that you're not focused on the bass, because I think most fans have that vision of like everybody in the band desperately wants their instrument to become the lead instrument.
It's true, but the goal as a mixer is to be able to hear everything. You know what I mean? Everything that you're mixing, you should be able to hear it. But when you're mixing, it's kind of like you have to imagine there's a frame, and you have to fit everything inside of that frame. But there's 3D, meaning the vocal is the closest thing to you. Right, and then after that, it would probably be the snare drum, and then there's, you know, this, you can move stuff to the right, you can move stuff to the left, but you can move stuff further back with effects. You know what I mean? Like the background vocals should literally be background vocals. You know what I mean? So it's like people ask me mixing questions. I also say, well, if you have to imagine that your stereo field, your left and your right speaker, is like a giant picture frame that has depth. And you have to kind of fit everything in there, left to right and front to back. And obviously whatever's closest to you should be the most important thing.
Right.
So, yeah. So just, you know, it's cool stuff, man. I love it.
No, that is really cool. I mean, I think it sounds excellent, and I can hear everything. And that's something that I appreciate. Like it's not muddy or anything like that. My two favorite songs on the album are Hollywood and Headlights and All Nighter. I think I really like the vibe of those songs, and just the, like, lyrically and everything. I just feel it speaks well to the band.
Oh, cool, man. I appreciate that. It's you know, when we finish a record, Paul and I, we have obviously our personal favorites, and then we kind of try and think of the record from the fan's perspective, meaning, you know, what are the people, and it's funny because people in America like songs that are completely different than people in Europe and you know, Canada and this and that. So it's like US and Canada are similar, but in Europe, like in the European countries, they're like completely different songs. So we like to have fun with it, Paul and I, trying to guess on,
guess like which songs people are going to gravitate towards. And we're usually right, but it's funny because All Nighter, you said it's one of your favorites, and that was one of Paul's, that's definitely, I think, Paul's favorite, and one of my favorites, yet that's one of everyone's least favorites.
Oh, really?
Which is funny. Yeah, it's just weird. Like, we're getting comments, we're getting the obvious comments about, like, Hollywood and Headlights and Falling for You, and a lot of people like Love is the Killer. And mm-hmm. then there's a lot of people that like the song Alive, which Paul and I liked the song when we were writing it, but when we finished it, we were kind of like, eh, we don't know if our fans are going to like that. That's why it's like almost at the end of the record. And we're getting a lot of comments on that song, and Paul's like, yeah, a lot of people like Alive. And I'm like, go figure. Like, I can't, you know what I mean? Like, I can't figure out what people are going to like. But the two, Paul and myself, I guess you think like us, we love Alive. I mean, All Nighter. Mm-hmm. We love All Nighter. And so it's like, those were kind of our favorites when we were finishing the record. We were like, yeah, All Nighter, man, it's bombastic. And it's got all the production stuff in it. So we were like, man, that song's killer. And like, no one said anything about it except you. This is funny, man. Oh, boy.
Well, to me, ultimately, besides the vibe of it, like, I like it because it actually sounds a little bit different from, I think, the rest of the songs.
Yeah, it does. It's definitely, like, I call it the production number because we just threw the kitchen sink in that. And you know, in the beginning, when we were, I just had that line. I just said, I'm going to pull an all-nighter, sleep all day like vampires. That's all I had for the song. And so I said, I love it, all-nighter. I didn't never heard a song called all-nighter before the title stuck out to me. And also, and I said, but this song's got to be heavy. And then Paul, I knew once I sent him the track and that chorus, I knew he was going to go bananas because he loves that kind of like shuffle, gudug. He loves that stuff. And like we were trying to do a song like this on the last album, and it kind of fell apart because when we were writing it, it was like too contrived to me. It was too like obvious, and I was like, "Yeah, go, I'm not feeling it." And we kind of threw it out. But then I was like, "I know Paul likes that kind of shuffle beat." And when I got that line, "All night or sleep all day like vampires," I go, "This is cool." I go, because we could talk about, you know, staying out all night, and that's what rock and roll's about, obviously, you know. So when I handed that to him, he was going bananas. He goes, "Oh my god, I have so many ideas for this, blah blah blah." And then he wrote, you know, the lyrics and that whole thing in the verse, it just came together really well. And we were having problems kind of you know, what to do with the song, because I says, this can't just be like a typical song, meaning verse chorus solo and an outro. I was like, we got to throw something in there to throw it off. And then that whole kind of production element with all the backwards voices and stuff coming in and out, and Rob went bananas playing guitar, meaning like, you know, I told him, I said, I called Rob up, I said, you take this song and I want tons of guitars on the song, like all kinds of stuff, counter melodies, counter parts. And he just went nuts, and to me, it's like one of the coolest songs on the record because of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
No, that's funny. I love the fact that there's a story behind that and that kind of thing. I think that's just just awesome.
Yeah, that song more than any other was the one that Paul and I were both just like, you know, what about this and what about that, you know, on the phone. And I was like, oh man, we could do something. Like I wanted it to be kind of like, for lack of a better term, our Gods of War, you know, Def Leppard, meaning like, you know, they have that whole section in there.
Yep.
With that all that weird, the talking voices. And I says, we got to do something like that. So that's what kind of, you know, I spent like a whole day just getting samples of stuff and army marching samples and all this stuff, and just threw it all in. And I was like, oh, this is cool. So it even worked out. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, that's great. Well, Bruno, I thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate everything that you've managed to accomplish and just how much time you've spent with me. I want you to give the fans the opportunity to, or just tell them where to find the album, because, I mean, hey, I think this is a great album that everybody should listen to and everybody should buy. So I want you to tell them where they can buy that.
Okay, cool. And all right, so if you want to get the record, the easiest thing to do would be to just find us on Facebook, or, you know, if you just search for The Defiance on Facebook or on Instagram, you'll find a link that will take you to every streaming service, meaning Spotify, iTunes, all of that. And it's also on Amazon. If you want to just go to Amazon, you could pick it up there. I'm not really sure about, I mean, I'm sure it's in the local record stores, but I think, I don't know how many of those are left. So it seems like everybody buys their records now online, like either from Amazon or from if there's a local retailer that carries this kind of music. The easiest thing to do would just be to find it on Amazon, or to find us on Facebook. On every one of our posts on Facebook, there's a link to get there's a link that you could click on that will take you to every place that you could possibly buy it from. So what I would suggest. And I'm sorry about all the long-winded answers. You know, once you wind me up, I could talk forever. And sorry about the whole thing with my kid at school and all that, about the interruption. You might want to edit that part out.
Hey, you know what? It is no problem. And as far as the long-winded answers goes, that's the way I like it. It's great, because I just, like, in my opinion, I'm a fan too. I want to hear the whole story, and so that's great. That's, you know, that's what I'm looking for.
And I appreciate the questions. There's a lot of people that call me for interviews that ask me, you know, the same three questions, like, over and over again. So I appreciate that you took a little time to think of some things that maybe I would have to think about to answer. So I appreciate that.
Well, that again, another one of my goals is just to make you think, and to try to, you know, because again, yeah, everybody can hear that interview, but it's always special when you can get to something new that maybe doesn't get talked about very much.
Cool.
Well, Bruno Ravel, thank you so much for being on the show. We have appreciated it immensely, and the new album is Zakusho from The Defiance, and I hope that it does extraordinarily well, and I wish you all the best in the future, and I do hope that you find your way back up to Calgary so that we can come see you live.
I would love to, and thanks to all your listeners, and thanks to you, of course, and it was a blast. So, yeah, go out, pick up the record, and sayonara.
All right. Thanks so much, Bruno. We totally appreciate it.
All right, thanks, man.